Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Before we start today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this episode of Speak Up is broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkamilam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here since time immemorial. And I want to start off today's episode with a piece I produced recently with the Walkers Caucus, a advocacy group based within Burnaby and New Westminster, but have a focus throughout the entire Lower Mainland on pedestrian safety. And recently, they were at New Westminster Public Library handing out free reflective materials for people to put on any sort of mobility device, so like a walker or a cane or a baby stroller. And they are very, very adamant about getting people to think more critically about their own personal safety when going on the street, you know, as a pedestrian, but as well as just policy-wise, what needs to be done in order to make the streets safer for those not in cars. And this is coming at a time especially where road caution has been urged because there have been 6 deaths in the Lower Mainland due to vehicle crashes in the past 3 days. So this is something that is not getting any better, and it's something that we really, really need to be mindful of, and obviously on an individual level be safe, but there is much, much more that needs to be done on an institutional and policy level as well to address this. So without further ado, here is my piece with the Walkers Caucus and Vic Leach. Reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The Walkers Caucus is an advocacy group for pedestrian safety throughout the Lower Mainland, including the cities of New Westminster and Burnaby. On December 4th, Vic Leach and Amy Wu, as representatives for the Walkers Caucus, were set up with a table at the entrance of the New Westminster Public Library. The table was covered in retroreflective materials, and their goal was to get as many passerbys as possible to stick on these materials to their common mobility devices, including canes, walkers, wheelchairs, baby carriages, strollers, carts, and other items. The goal of this event was to increase pedestrian visibility for road users while also educating people on the risks of walking in areas with poor visibility and road-focused infrastructure. A common sentiment expressed by people who stopped by the table was that this initiative was a great idea, but they had never considered the need to increase their visibility as a pedestrian before. CJSF was able to speak with Vic Leach on the background behind this event and the lessons that he hoped it conveyed for those who passed by.
We're here to put on reflective material on canes and walkers and baby carriages, just so that when people are out at night, they can be seen by drivers of cars because the light will reflect back to them. So that's one of the main things. We understand that in BC we have about 2,300 people that are injured from walking at night. And so those people are going to be going into the hospital, and that's things that could be changed quickly.
Vic Leach then went on to explain the increased risks that pedestrians face when walking at night.
But it's been sort of a passion of mine because of, on pedestrian safety, they said that about 50 to 60% of the injuries take place in the evening or at night. We know that somewhere around about 42% of the deaths with pedestrians takes place at night. Could be higher in certain areas. So drivers are not very good at seeing an individual when they're in dark clothing or even in light clothing because they have so many distractions as they're driving.
Later on, Vic Leach then brought up what some other countries are doing in order to effectively address pedestrian safety.
In studies, most people are not even aware in Canada that there's the United Nations has declared 2021 to 2030 as a decade of action for road safety. This is the second decade of action for road safety declared by the UN. The first one was 2011 to 2020. And we found that Norway has done the best in the world, as far as we can see. And if we did a direct comparison with Norway to BC, we find that going back to a pre-COVID year in 2019, Norway had a population of 5.3 million and BC was at 5.1 million. Norway had 3.8 million motor vehicles and BC only had 3.4. So they had more vehicles, but they ended up with 380 pedestrians injured in that year, and BC ended up with 2,200, six and a half times as many. So that's why we're trying to do things. Well, they're doing some of the things, but it's we found that in Norway, one of the other things that is that they've also reduced the blood alcohol content down to 0.02. That's a federal project. We also found that you have to change the roads and pathways so that people will feel safer. So one of the other things that we're applying to do is get a definition for the term curb ramp, which is the smooth graded transition from the sidewalk to the road. That will allow pedestrians to cross the road in a little bit more time. We've been out with blind people and showing them that if the ramp goes down into the middle of the crosswalk, it's better than going into the middle of the intersection because a blind person can't see where the middle of the intersection or the middle of the crosswalk is. So those are things that we're trying to do.
Vic Leach, Amy Wu, and the Walkers Caucus continue to advocate for safer road conditions for pedestrians, as well as stricter regulations for increasingly popular modes of transportation, such as e-scooters. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. And once again, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour. That was my little discussion I had with Vic Leach of the Walkers Caucus, someone who I spoke with last December when we went on a blind-led walk throughout the Lower Lonsdale area of North Vancouver. And it was a really eye-opening experience. You know, the ethos of it, the message trying to be conveyed there was essentially that you are never going to know how to fully make streets and sidewalks and areas like that safer for everyone until you go on a walk with someone who is blind. And that really taught me a lot. So I'm very thankful for Vic Leach and everything that he has shown and advocated for in that regard. We are going to be switching it up all the way to Kitimat, BC. This is a news piece that was produced by Pamela Hassan from CICK News in Smithers, but this is a piece regarding Kitimat Council rejecting a proposal for a new environmental committee. Apparently, a motion to form a new environmental committee in the district of Kitimat failed to pass at a recent council meeting, despite growing community concerns over industrial impacts such as flaring. This is that piece.
This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, the District of Kitimat Council has failed to pass a motion proposed by Councillor Jerry Leibel to form an environmental committee for the district. He says that council is split between environment first and industry first votes, but thinks there's room for both. Here he is now.
Yep, my name is Jerry Leibel. I'm a councillor on the district of Kitimat. Kitimat is kind of it's on you know it's called the marvel of nature and industry. So very much the two are side by side. Sometimes that seems oppositional, but you know I believe that you can preserve your environment while promoting industry as well. So the intent behind the motion was to give the public a platform on which to address environmental issues, particularly related to flaring, which was what brought the motion on in the first place.
Okay, great. Was there feedback or comments that you got from your fellow councillors when this motion failed to pass?
What usually happens in our council is, you know, we're pretty split along the lines of who's, you know, sort of pro industry and who's pro environment and industry. And it's normally a 4-3 vote. And so most issues relating to the environment don't get much further than the initial motion.
The District of Kitimat has an environmental committee called the Kitimat Airshed Group that was created following a 2019 mediated settlement involving Rio Tinto, the BC Ministry of Environment, local appellants, and Unifor 2301. The agreement resolved appeals related to Rio Tinto's sulfur dioxide monitoring program. Later that year, core members were invited by the ministry to help shape the new group and created Kitimat Airshed Group's bylaws. So why does Councillor Leibel think there needs to be another committee?
Oh, can you tell me what are the terms of reference for this proposed committee, just so that myself and our listeners just kind of have a an idea of what the scope of this committee would be?
So the terms of reference for the committee, what we'll do is we'll have staff and councillors attend purely to hear what the community is saying and to answer questions from the committee on the issues that we are aware of.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed that you proposed a discussion about the potential use of funds to employ a biologist for the district of Kitimat.
So a few councils actually have biologists on staff that will advise their engineering, will advise their planning as to issues relating to development and the environment. Had a lot of subject matter experts from industry presenting before council. And my kind of wish was to balance the industry's subject matter experts with our own experts to critically analyze the data that they were presenting to us so that from a council point of view, have independent verified information from an independent consultant that we employ.
Mm-hmm. Was this proposed by you, your idea, or were you hearing from like Kitimat Terrace Air Quality Coalition and KAG?
So we had two of our community members come forward to a council meeting and raise the issue of the effects of flaring on their quality of life. And the one presenter actually mentioned that he would be prepared to sit on a committee that was formulated by the District of Kitimat. So that really came about as a result of the the requests from our two community members for some kind of relief from the effects of flaring.
Oh, Councillor Leibel, is there anything that I didn't ask about this committee or in this conversation that you think is important to be included?
I think a lot of the time we look at a prosperity of a community as in what the local economy is like. I also see the prosperity of a community and the quality of its environment. We work hard and we like to have an environment into which we can go and play. So it's critical for our community that there is an environment that, you know, is we balance out the need for industry with the need to preserve what we have, to preserve our environment. Mm-hmm. As it is, we have LNG Canada, we have Cedar LNG, which is starting off now, and there are talks of a third LNG project in Kitimat, which would, I feel would severely impact our environment. So it is something I'm passionate about because this is a community that I chose to live in. And I think it's important that as council, we balance the needs for a strong local economy, a strong provincial and federal economy with the needs of our community, and protecting the environment is part of that. So the two committee members that came to council, they didn't dispute how critically important industry is for for Canada and for our community, but they were concerned that the impacts of the flaring weren't being mitigated properly, and that they came to council be heard. And I personally felt that it was important that we establish this committee to give them that voice, to sit them down with members of industry and other concerned environmental groups to really look at strategies to minimize the impact of industry on their, certainly their enjoyment of Kitimat.
Mm-hmm. And how do you make this motion pass?
I put forward a motion, calling for money to be spent on looking into the health of our watershed, which is critically important for Kitimat because we have a pretty small watershed and we rely on the Kitimat River for water, not just the industry, but for residential as well. And, keenly aware that our watershed is under pressure. There is, clear cutting that is happening, and we need to preserve that watershed because that is this community's lifeline. So that there is always a give and take on any council. And I'm of the firm belief that when I come to council, I come in with the information that I need, and I make the decision at the council, listening to arguments. And I have changed my vote midstream based on what I've heard from other councillors. So I always hope that the information that I provide, the reports that I do, will go some way in swaying councillors to see the benefits of preserving our environment. And it's interesting that one of our councillors, Graham Pitzel, actually lives in Strawberry Meadows and has personally experienced the effects of it. And LNG Canada has they have done their due diligence. They have put up monitoring equipment around Kitimat, and in the presentation they made last night, they put a lot of emphasis on they're aware of the impacts. They weren't expecting the intensity of the effects of the flaring, and they did kind of acknowledge that last night. And looking forward at mitigation, very much there's the argument that this is a temporary inconvenience, that it is during the startup, and that these flaring events are out of the ordinary and won't be commonplace once LNG Canada is running at full steam. One of the points I raised last night with their noise specialist was I wanted to find out whether they had a baseline of the kind of ambient noises. And what I wanted to do was compare the baseline with where we're at now, because this isn't just about LNG Canada, but we're looking at further industries and the cumulative effect of that on our community and our environment. The previous presentation by LNG Canada, I did ask about trains 3 and 4, and the indication I got it was that we're looking at a duplication of the current noise when they, when and if they go ahead with trains 3 and 4, because that decision hasn't been made yet. And the communication was that, yes, it would be similar to what we're currently experiencing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. You know, the thing with the environment is once it's gone, it's gone.
Thank you to Kitimat Councillor Jerry Leibel for speaking to me. I also reached out to Kitimat Terrace Clean Air Coalition, a group that have been operating since 2018 and advocate for better monitoring of air quality in Kitimat. Here's the Kitimat Terrace Clean Air Coalition president, Steve Stannis, now.
My name is Steve Stannis. I live in Kitimat, British Columbia. I am the president of an environmental group. We are advocating to industry to make the Industrial Avenue air quality monitoring station to include two existing SO2 monitoring with NO2 at that station. NO2 is the main emitter emissions from LNG Canada. Data collection at that station is mostly from Rio Tinto. We also advocate that, I don't know if you're aware that the BC Ministry of Environment and Climate Change maintain and operate a network of air quality monitoring stations throughout BC, and the exception is in Kitimat. The air quality monitoring stations under their permit is being managed and operated by industry in Kitimat. But the air quality network here in Kitimat, we like to see it to be operated and managed by a third party.
What are some effects of poor air quality that people might not notice?
Well, we think some of the effects may be health impacts to people, especially people with respiratory issues. We like to see better management of emissions from industry.
I really appreciate you taking the time and introducing me a little more intimately to what your group does. Steve, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Okay, good, Pamela. Good to talk to you.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Once again, thank you to Pam Hassan and CSK News for that piece. And you are back listening to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Before we get into the next section of this hour, we're going to be taking a bit of a music break with a band that has just been dominating the charts here at CJSF. This next track, Blue Blazer, by none other than Self Care. And once again, you are listening to Speak Up, only on a CJSF 90.1 FM. That last track was Blue Blazer by Self Care. Coming up, we have a full-length interview that was done by one of our amazing volunteers here at CJSF. This is an interview coming from Florentina Rusli. And this was an interview that she did with the owners of the Tamam Fine Palestinian Cuisine in Vancouver, speaking to them about their role within the Palestinian community here in Vancouver, as well as some of the events that they have going on at their restaurant in the coming months and ones that have already occurred. So without further ado, here is Florentina speaking with the owners of Tamam Restaurant in Vancouver.
Hello, my name is Florentina, and today I'm visiting Vancouver's own Tamam, a Palestinian fine cuisine restaurant. I'm joined today here with the lovely Sobi. So, Sobi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Flo.
Yeah.
Thank you, Flo, for the interview and for the introduction.
Yeah. So maybe we could start things off first with a little bit of an introduction of yourself.
About myself. Again, my name is Subhi Al-Zubaydi. I'm Palestinian, born and raised in Palestine. My background in studied economics, filmmaking, cinema Ooh. Studies, and visual media, visual communication.
Oh, where did you study?
I studied in Palestine, in New York City, and SFU.
All over the world. SFU, too.
Yeah.
Wow. Gosh.
And I'm a poet. I write poetry since I was a kid. Filmmaker, I made many films about Palestine, documentaries, and I also have interest in scholarly research. So I do research about Palestinian culture and arts, especially Palestinian cinema and visual arts.
I guess from there, maybe you could tell a little bit more about the restaurant as well.
Yeah, about the restaurant. So I came with my wife here and our daughter, Kenza. She was 4 or 5 years old in 2006. I came to do my PhD at SFU. And like a year or so after our arrival here, we started to notice that the absence, the invisibility of Palestinian culture. Most people we know or we met, we talked to, you know, their knowledge about Palestine comes from mainstream media, basically, or, you know, maybe a little bit more than social mainstream media, but still it's very limited. And it's very political knowledge about our culture. So myself and Tamam, we decided we want to do something that extends Palestinian culture here in Vancouver. And we both artists. Tamam is also a visual artist. She's a painter, actress, and she was a TV hostess in Palestine. So, you know, we're always like, we come from the arts and spent all our life, like, I did nothing but work and I was teaching and making films in Palestine and writing. So all our lives we were working in culture. However, we're not business people, like we don't have a background in business really, but Tamam is a really good cook.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she just, like, the way she paints, so you give her any ingredients and she can tend them, make fascinating things, you know. And she loved, I mean, we, you know, after we married, we lived together, and little by little I started to realize her creativity in cooking. She never manifested it really. She always liked talking. So here in Vancouver, actually, we decided that maybe the best to open a restaurant to do food, introduce food. But the whole thing, like we until now, if you look at the restaurant, it's like a gallery really. It's like
really
we show our food, but also all the artwork here is the man's artwork on this wall.
Really,
my artwork and the other wall inside.
Gosh.
So this painting also, like a Mexican artist with the man, and we painted. So we maintain like our interest in the arts, and you know now it's like a gallery of food and art.
It's
So we learned really so much about food, things that I myself never thought about. I never like really took, in Palestine, I thought about food when I got hungry.
Yeah.
That's all really, but I never theorized food, or maybe I should have, but here, you know, we just learned, I learned like how food is amazing in terms of communicating one's culture to another culture.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like, you know, I spent my life, most of my life, as I mentioned, I'm a filmmaker, writer, teacher. So I'm always talking to people about Palestine, whether poetry, film, or any other intellectual capacity. But like, you know, and always people listen and they interact and things, but they always like filter what you say. People come with their languages, their backgrounds, their many things, right? And they have to like think about what you say. They like it, they don't like it, they agree, they don't agree. You know, but with food, there isn't this problem. With food, people eat if they like your food. Oh my God, this is Palestinian food, yes.
Yeah.
Wow, this is fascinating.
Really,
so it really builds a relationship.
It does.
That is not intellectual, but bodily or physical relationship, because the food goes inside the body.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't think about it.
Yeah.
And it becomes, so they become more open, susceptible to learn about Palestine. The conversation can go in any direction. And it works. Like, it really works in terms. And food, you know, like, talking about food is not all talking about eating, but talking about cooking, about harvesting, about where the food comes from, about geography, about history. Food takes you in so many, about memory and about community, you know. Since October 7th, you know, because it's an authentic Palestinian restaurant. And we are two proud Palestinians, not, you know, before October, because since we came, we are proud of our culture, we're two proud Palestinians, and we practice this and say this every day, you know, we're not shy about it, we're not afraid from it. But we noticed also, like, how eating Palestinian food in the last 2 years became... There is an added value.
Okay.
You know, when people come to eat, it's like they come to eat, they talk about the food, they talk to us. This place has become a cultural hub, a cultural center where people come to express their solidarity with Palestine. You know, even by eating Palestinian food, a lot of people like, we get like now, the way we get our food, our catering orders, most 90% of the catering orders, there is no other food we would like to share with our whoever, but Palestinian food. And I know not because we're just because of the general environment and people feel like there is an added value, moral or ethical or political value to doing business with Palestinian food, that they already like the food. So
I mean, it's kind of also like making a stand too. It's supporting your business. It's supporting Palestine in general.
Exactly.
Especially, yeah, since you've done a lot for Palestinian activism as well. Yeah, you guys had like that fundraising event last year in like January, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was also looking through like your social media as well. You've been raising awareness well before the October 7th.
Event. All our lives since we. This is the destiny of any Palestinian intellectual or artist, that you are really, because of our situation and the political realities of our life. So you cannot really, we don't have the pleasure, we don't have the luxury of thinking outside of our issues. You know, like I made films, I always said like I would love to make a film about something that is not political or doesn't have political ramifications or manifestations, but I am incapable of making anything or write a book or that doesn't deal with my existential realities. I am incapable of doing this to you. So, yes, everything we do, you know, whether my films, my writings, it's all has to do with Palestine and with what we're going through.
There's that wave.
Yeah.
Although you guys cover a lot of information about Palestine, things that normal, I guess, media outlets that I or like my peers usually rely on is not covered by the things you guys are showing there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we have a, because we lived all our lives in Palestine, so we grew up there. And when we speak, from there, you know, we know our families are there, our friends are there, our communities are there, our hearts are there. But also, we're not like politicians. We're artists, and artists are, you know, usually creative, supposedly creative people who come up with creative ways to express things different. Even like, you know, I much prefer artists talking, doing politics than politicians doing politics, because it's nuanced, accentuated. This is like, and I think, yes, the things we touch, the things we talk about, the things we see, and the way we see things that are happening in Palestine, you know, it's very personal. We grew up, we're both born in the old city of Jerusalem. Tamashi grew up in the old city of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a refugee camp outside of Jerusalem. My personal story, for example, as a Palestinian refugee, my parents were living a beautiful life in their home, and they were like landowners, and they traveled 3-4 times a year, even back in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. Suddenly they woke up and someone else taking their home, and they found themselves in a tent, that only the shoes in their feet, nothing, you know. So this is a tragedy, this personal tragedy, it's intergenerational tragedy, it's not the tragedy of our parents only, you know. We Palestinians, all of us suffer from intergenerational trauma that really, you know, what it just, you know, from our parents and what happened to them. But also, you know, we are people of conviction because we know what happened to us is wrong, what happened to us is unfair. Mm-hmm. We're just asking for our homes back. You cannot be more determined. I'll tell you what. I was born in 61. When I was about 1961, the West Bank, so Palestine was occupied, or part of Palestine was occupied in 1948, right? West Bank, from 1961 until it was reoccupied in 1967, from 1948 to 1967, was under Jordanian rule. Gaza was under Egyptian rule. So we were so scattered. There were no connections, like not phone, no letters, no nothing. You cannot talk to each other. So we were very fragmented. So my father, when the Zionists occupied the rest of Palestine, so we were living under Jordanian rule from 1948 to 1967, right? Uh-huh. Now in 1967, the Israelis occupied Gaza and the West Bank. So now all of Palestine became under Israeli occupation. Before that, like, we are in the West Bank. I couldn't go to Jaffa or Haifa or Gaza. Everybody, you cannot move. After 1960, because it's all under one occupation, we could move now. Every parent did. Those who were forced to leave Palestine took their children to see their homes, their former homes. So my father took us, all of us, the children, to his home in the village of Safriya, where he was kicked out in 1948. The home was still there, green, light green, big house, orchards, citrus orchard in front of it. And we stood there, and my father, like, he recognized there was a clay water jug, big ones. Villagers, they used to put water in them because it stays cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he was showing us the house. Then a woman, a Jewish woman, comes out from inside the house and she speaks Hebrew with my father. They exchange a few words. She goes back inside. She comes back and she wants to give my father some oranges. He refused to take them. Yeah. But all I could see, tears in his eyes. So that really, that event when I was about 7 or 8 years old informed the rest of my life, informed me, my character. This was the most traumatizing event that I have ever lived. And till now, I can never forget it. Till now, I can never step outside of the reality that was presented to me by seeing someone else living in our home. With no repercussions. They just stole the home and they live there, and we are refugees. We don't have a home, we live under it. This reality really shaped a lot of who I am today. you know, how I think about justice, how I think about the world, how I think about equality, how I think about freedom, how I think about so many things. And the way I see, like, the Palestinian problem, or I see so many things, you know, I am informed by this event.
I feel like most people around me always assume food as, like, just a source of sustenance. Oh, I need to eat food.
Yeah, right.
But you have this interesting take on how food's relevant as a symbol almost.
Absolutely.
Like, political
Look,
resistance.
For example, to give you an example, look how much of that, look, what happened to the Palestinians, or what's happening to the Palestinians, have happened to the indigenous people here in North America. Their land was taken away from them, their mountains, their rivers. It was genocidal policies. They tried to get rid of them, residential schools. They forbid them to speak their language. They put poison in their blankets to kill them. They soak them with alcohol and drugs to try and make them miserable and get rid of the Indian people here. But they did not. They could not. Now, if you go back and you see what really sustained the indigenous culture and the indigenous identity, food at the core of the whole thing, they're cooking. They're harvesting, they're gathering, they're fishing. The way they sit and the weeks they take to dry the fish and to smoke the fish, the stories they tell, the fact that they eat together, what they do together is communal. It's the production of memory together. That really what sustained their sense of identity. And the stories they told. Stories narrate us. Stories narrate us. Stories are also, they become like lighthouses, our narrative, lighthouses that guide us. We tell stories, we remember stories. Food in Palestine, you know, it's communal. We eat together, we harvest together. It's like, I really only when I left to study in New York, I discovered like food as a commodity that you consume. And food is like a sign of status, that where you eat and how much you pay, in what restaurant you eat and with whom you eat, which is the state of eating in North American culture now. You know, people sit down before, like before, in the old times we used to pray, people used to pray before they eat, now they take pictures. Just to stress the fact that this fascination, this visual culture and this gratification, personal gratification that we get from eating. So eating has become less and less communal, less and less in an infrastructure that reproduces communities and their memories and their stories. Now it's just it's like sexualization of our culture. Like it became really just a personal thing that gratifies the person who eats, you know, and Uber brings you the food from wherever, and you know. So food for us is not really just about consumption or about nutrition, really. No. Food, as I said, is a site upon which we reconstruct our sense of identity. We gather, we remember, we tell stories, we remember stories. Food connects us to our geographies, to connects us to our ancestors. You know, most like the food we serve here at the restaurant, Frieke. I mean, Frieke, like you mentioned the word Frieke, I can see my father, my grandfather, my grandmother. I can remember the road to my grandmother's house and where they used to dry the Frieke. You know, this is the beauty of it, that it really, food takes you in so many directions, but connects you to your land and to your history and to your ancestors. That's the beauty of food. And that's why I think, this is why also, we Palestinians, we didn't really understand, not only me, but many of us, we take food for granted, right? You never think like, but only when you are forced to, when someone else come take hummus is ours, hummus is Israeli, this is Israeli, this is not your food, this is not, and you become like, oh, okay. You know, little by little now, so many Palestinian young enthusiasts or cooks, they treat food not only as a commodity that we eat, but a cultural substance, cultural material that can help reconstitute our existence and our sense of identity.
Yeah. I was not aware Israelis were taking your food, though. That's insane.
Well, I mean, not only our, like, you know, when they come and they change the names of the street, change the names of all archaeological sites, change the names of all their towns and villages, kick you out and tell you you don't exist, your culture don't exist, you don't have a history here. You know, you don't exist. You are facing somebody who, like, kill you, then say, so you did not exist. So how do you fight them? You fight them with your connection to the land, you know. You fight them with, you know, the narrating beyond words that you have thousands of years of history. You can see it in my food, in my, you know, in many things we do here in this country, in this land. I have not really, like, I know the writings about food and food and colonialism, food and identity, food and many things, but, you know, still it's an understudied field. But it is a very vibrant and very worth studying, honestly. And the things, again, like, I really never, like, learned so much just from having this restaurant here and doing food and talking about food with people and doing food with the purpose of culture, not money. So that, you know, helps us a lot in understand a lot more about food. Well, the restaurant, it's been honestly a successful story. Like, from 2012 when we started, it wasn't a restaurant. It was a cafe. They didn't have, like, the equipment or anything. So we built it little by little, and until now it's a class A restaurant, and with very loyal clientele. A place where we provide a safe space for the community to gather, for people who, and we our logo or what we say in our Instagram, like, may our food be a bridge that connects you further with Palestine. That's really what we want to do, and I think to a great extent we succeeded. Creating this bridge that connects people with Palestine. And especially in the last 2 years, you know, as you mentioned, we did the fundraisers. We did a Mother's Day fundraiser that was a musical event here in Vancouver last May. So that people in the community feel that we have created a space, an authentic space, that two Palestinians and a Palestinian restaurant, and we create, you know, we're not afraid, we're not shy about it. Sometimes people in from the community, activists, or we give them the space to use on Mondays because we are closed. They can do embroidery. They can do other activities, and they fundraise. They do, starting next month, every Monday, first Monday of the month, we have a poetry salon.
Ooh.
And I tell you, poetry is amazing. Like, I as I mentioned, I wrote poetry when I was... my first creative activity was writing poetry, and I wrote some of the most, I would say most popular or famous songs came from Palestine. I co-wrote some of those songs.
Ooh,
yeah,
wow.
That's like 30 something years ago. So, and I really like, also, poetry re-emerged during the last 2 years as a very, vital, vibrant way of communication. People come and they come and leave donation and with a poem. We come to open the restaurant and found people put poems under the door. Poetry was a great deal of the communication with people, how people interacted with us through poetry. So we did a couple of poetry readings, and they were just beautiful. So now, and more poets. And I tell you what, the first theme of the poetry, our first poetry meeting, the theme is a poetry of resistance. We're going to gather Palestinian, indigenous, and South African poetry. So these are three communities of people who grappled with settler colonialism, you know, too. So we want to see how, through poetry, how these three communities of people dealt with settler colonialism and how they brought it through their poetry. So we're gonna do this, and maybe 1 week to 3-4 weeks until we, like, just go through. So every time we're gonna have, like, a theme around which, like, we invite poets to come and audience to come, and we do it on Monday when the restaurant is closed. and it's a free event for everybody.
Yeah. For any listeners who are interested, where could they find us?
Our Instagram. Command Fine Palestinian Cuisine. Yeah, our Instagram will be, we're in the final stages now. Soon we'll be announcing the first poetry salon. And in addition to this, we are planning in the very near future, we're going to do a film festival that also focuses on communities. We're going to bring films and filmmakers and panel discussions that bring together indigenous Palestinian and South African films and filmmakers and artists. And we're going to do food, dance, and film, but mostly we're going to focus as a film festival. But the idea is to really, there is a lot, you know, common and shared experience, shared realities. Mm-hmm. But yet there is a lot of differences between these communities. Mm-hmm. And the only way we can bridge those differences and learn and, you know, communicate these shareable values, these, you know, the struggle, the resistance, is that the more we create activities together, language, images, writings, paintings, films, that speak the truth of our existence, the truth of our experience, we create language and more vocabulary for future generations to make it more easier to grasp the realities of those communities. And we can do this only by creating more and more activities. So poetry, film, and I'm a believer in art. I believe in art more than I believe in God, really, or religion. And I believe in the efficiency of art, freeing our minds and our hearts, you know. Yeah.
To any listeners interested, you guys could find them at 2616 Hastings Street.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And they're open Tuesdays to Saturdays.
We are open Tuesday to Saturday at 5 p.m.
Thank you guys for listening. And thank you again to Shelby for joining me.
Anytime, Florentine. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you and SFU and the students at SFU. We did, all the best to you. And the only thing you need to come and eat the food here, try our food. Make you bring your family with you.
Once again, thank you so much to Flo as well as Sobi El Zobayadi of Tamam Fine Palestinian Cuisine for that interview. Really amazing stuff. And again, Tamam Fine Palestinian Cuisine is on East Hastings Street in Vancouver, BC. So go check it out. It looks like not just for food, but for also poetry events and other community events going on there. You can find that at their website, tamam.ca. Before we get into the end of this hour, here's a bird note.
This is Bird Note. The Lewis's woodpecker's glossy dark green back, red face, and pink belly make it look as if it belongs in a tropical forest. But this species is, in fact, an icon of the American West. A temperate migrant, this bird breeds across the western states in mature ponderosa pine forests, and then moves south in winter. A century of logging and fire control has taken its toll on these mature pine forests, the preferred nest site for the Lewis's woodpecker. It takes a long time for a ponderosa pine to grow large enough for the woodpecker to carve out a nest cavity. As nest holes have become scarcer, so have many other species that rely on them. For example, the tiny flammulated owl has also declined. The moths that make up its diet are absent during northern winters, so it is highly migratory, wintering in Mexico and Central America. Thus, its fate is also tied to the health of tropical habitats. But there is hope. Lewis's woodpeckers also nest along rivers in large cottonwoods, trees of little value for timber. Furthermore, many remaining tracts of old-growth ponderosas are protected on public lands, and the trees are growing larger as we speak. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
For one final time, we are back this hour with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This has been your host, Danny Nesvedarani. thank you to every single person who contributes to Speak Up here at CJSF. Thank you to Flo for that amazing interview. Thank you to Pam Hassan from CICK News for her piece on the affairs of Kitimat Council. And thank you all for listening this hour. Before Democracy Now, right at 11, I'm going to be ending off with one last track. This is High Roller from Sourdope. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in.